The Devin Nunes Podcast separates fact from fiction. Stay informed. Download the Devin Nunes Podcast today. Available for free at iTunes.
We're back at Victor Davis Hanson's farm, in his farmhouse, to do another book review. I really enjoy these book reviews, but this one is really special because I was able to get an early copy of this book when it came out a couple of years ago. And this podcast is going to be more historical in nature, and we're going to talk about the Second World War. And the book that Victor Davis Hanson wrote a couple of years ago is called The Second World Wars. Victor, welcome back. And why do you call it the Second World Wars with an S?
For two reasons. One, that the word Second World War didn't really come into common use until the invasion of the Soviet Union on June 22nd, 1941. By that I mean, if we were alive in 39 and 40, there was the Polish War, the Danish War, the Norwegian War, the invasion of Yugoslavia, the invasion of Greece, the invasion of France, Belgium, and Luxembourg, and the fighting in North Africa.
And Japan.
Well, not yet. Japan was fighting in China, and people were still calling World War I the Great War. But then when Hitler turned on his ally, de facto ally, Stalin, and went into the Soviet Union in June 22nd, 41, then all of a sudden people said, wow, all of these isolated wars are now part of a huge war, and maybe it's a Second World War, and the name Great War went out of use, and they started calling World War I World War I. And that weird year, 1941, that was sealed by the second event of Japan attacking on December 7th the United States, and then on the 8th, British bases in Malaysia, and then and Hong Kong, etc., and then the declaration on December 11th of Italy and Germany of war on the United States. And people were freaked out by that because they thought, you know, we're going to fight Japan for 4 days, they thought, but we didn't do anything to Germany, and yet they declared war on us. But when that happened, then it was clearly a Second World Wars. All these wars were combined. And then the other thing was, a lot of these wars had nothing to do with each other in the manner in which they fought. There was a submarine campaign. There was a strategic bombing campaign. There was jungle fighting in Burma. There was island hopping in the Pacific. There was tank warfare in Europe. But if you ask a particular soldier who was in a Sherman tank in Normandy, do you know what's going on in Burma? He would have no idea.
He wouldn't know.
No idea.
So one of the things that I really like about this book is that you can basically pick it up and open to any page and read it. And I don't know if you set out to write it that way, but one of the, you know, each part, and you first talk about air in part two, water in part three, earth in part four. And anywhere that you kind of open up those chapters, you can just go in there if you want to hear about, for example, in part two, when you say air, you talk about the technology. This is not just your history book where you write it from, here's what happened in 1938, 39, 40, 41. You actually write it as, hey, if you want to know about weapons that were used in the air, here's a chapter on it, and here's kind of how they were being used in the Second World Wars that were going on at the time. Did you write it with that in mind?
I did, but I had a common theme, and the common theme was that a jet or a V-2 rocket or a B-29 just don't exist, or they weren't created. They're part of a process or a strategy or an economic investment, and therefore some are stupid and some are wise. And those decisions will affect thousands of people, whether they get killed or stay alive. Give you one example. When we invested in the Manhattan Project, that was $1 billion, and the B-29 was $2 billion. That's a lot of money in today's dollars. But they were very practical investments. You had a bomber that could carry a bomb, and even without the atomic bomb, once LeMay took in, the B-29 program destroyed 75% of the industrial production of Japan before the bomb. The Germans...
Those were the bombings over Tokyo,
yes,
correct?
Yes, from March 10th, 1945, all the way to the end of the war. But the Germans spent about almost half that in the V-1 and V-2. if you look at the amount of explosive that was delivered to Britain by those rockets, it was minuscule. It was a terrible investment. They were pound for pound, they paid about 100 times more to bring a pound of explosives over London very inaccurately than a B-17 or a B-24 or a Lancaster was doing over Hamburg or Kiel or Berlin. And so had Hitler just said, well, this is really great, this V-1, this rocket program, but let's just build some four-engine bombers first that work, it would have been a much smarter idea. And that was true of Germany never building an aircraft carrier, but building these monstrous battleships, or Japan building the Yamato or the Musashi when they could have built 20 destroyers.
So that's it. So that's actually a great transition. So you move from air, which you have a chapter on air, and you brought up, and I remember that piece talking about some of the mistakes that were made and on the investments that could have been made that would have changed the war. But you just started talking about naval strategy, naval equipment. And you were moving in that direction, and that's part three of your book, and you call it, simply titled Water. So when you look at the changes that were made and the developments that were made, one of the things that amazes me is how many ships the United States of America was able to put out in such a short amount of time.
Yeah.
Can you walk us through what made that possible?
When the war started, the United States and in terms of tonnage, had the second largest navy in the world after Britain, and then Japan was third. But in the Pacific, of course, we were outnumbered because we had a two-ocean navy, and they didn't. They could concentrate in the Pacific. But when the war ended, the United States had more ships at sea than all the navies of the world combined, 7,500 of them. And that was possible largely because Roosevelt had a war production board, and there were people like Henry Kaiser, Henry Ford, William Knudsen from GM, and believe it or not, for a socialist president, he allowed them enormous latitude. So they built the Kaiser shipyards in Seattle, Portland, and Oakland. They just went in and tore up neighborhoods. They built an assembly line ramp, and they were turning out a Liberty, 10,000-ton Liberty ship about every week. And
as those were like the transport carriers.
Yes,
they were Liberty for logistics.
And victory ships. Yeah. And so when you look at the communications of OKW, that's a German high command, they were looking at phenomenal kill rates in 1941. They call it the hot, happy time. They were destroying 10 million tons of shipping a month. And Hitler was saying, pretty soon we're going to starve England out. But they started to notice something, that their intelligence showed that shipments of oil, wheat, foodstuffs, ammunition, steel were going up. And they couldn't figure it out because never in their right mind could they figure that the United States could produce such shipping. And so even though they were losing an incredible amount, the amount of shipping that got through increased. And then when they started developing sonar and aerial attacks on U-boats, and they started to build, I mean, they built destroyers and destroyer escorts at such a phenomenal rate, and escort carriers that the Germans just, they didn't believe their own statistics. And so by 1943, every convoy had destroyer escorts. They had light carriers with fighters that were flying 300 miles ahead. And they, 40,000 German U-boaters didn't come home. They absolutely wiped out the submarine threat by late 43. It didn't exist anymore.
Right.
They just outbuilt them.
Well, they always say that logistics wins wars.
It does.
And that was one of the things, being able to produce a navy as quickly as we were able to do it really saved a lot of lives at the end of the war when you look back. So you move next into the infantry, and you talk about the infantry, and then you talk about the tanks and artillery also. So what would you say that would surprise people when they read your book? Something that they wouldn't know that hasn't been out there very much in terms of the differences in infantry.
Yeah. Well, the German soldier, even though Germany lost the war and lost almost 4 million people, 7 million people dead, the German soldier, even in defeat, killed three, in the last year of the war, they killed three Russians for everyone they lost. They killed 1.5 Americans. So that was the problem we had with them. They were the best army in the world. They were the best equipped. And how do you defeat them? But the way that we defeated them was we didn't have to be perfect to be good. So we make fun of the Sherman tank because a Tiger or a Panther tank with an 88 millimeter gun could blow them apart at 2 miles. Sherman had a 75. It would just bounce off. But we made 50,000 Shermans, and they only made 1,400 Tiger tanks, and they only made 5,500 Panthers. And what I'm getting at is the odds of a Sherman ever seeing a Panther were very rare.
Right.
And so the Sherman, you could take the transmission out in 3 hours. The Panther, you had to send it back to the factory. For 10 hours of road use, you had 1 hour of maintenance on a Sherman. For 1 hour of use, you had 1 hour of maintenance on a Tiger. So what I'm getting at is Germany was craftsmanship, fine calibrations, wonderful armor, huge guns, but they were so delicate and they were so hard to maintain that the Americans just went in these Shermans and, you know, they were very practical. If you saw a Tiger, then you said, well, maybe we should put one of these British 17-pound guns in it, and they put it into a Sherman. If they got it Norman, they say, maybe we should sweep the beach. They took a Sherman and put a what they called an alligator to sweep mines off. They put Rhino, those are tusks on it, to break up the hedgerows. So the American Army was based on practicality, and they had a good Army weapon, the M1, very practical, very easy to use, very accurate. They had the Sherman. They had air support. If you took the German soldier and you looked at his quality of his uniform, his gear, his 88 millimeter artillery support, the quality of an ME BF-109, FW-190, they were better, but they were in such short supply and they were so hard to maintain, they were just overwhelmed. And we created things that were almost as good and yet outnumbered them 10, 20 to 1. So we just buried them with production. And the American soldier was very good. It's just that he had only been fighting since 1942 in November, and the German soldier had been fighting since 39. And in America, if you were a soldier, you kind of got drafted. In other words, everybody wanted to, if you're going to go to World War II, you join the Navy or you join the Army Air Force. Or you join the Merchant Marines. If you didn't do that, you got drafted in the Army. So the Army was not a high-prestige arm of the military. In Germany, it was just the opposite. The German Army was so famous in 1870 and 1914 that all of the talent and all of the people wanted to go in the German Army, and it had such elan. And it had, by the time we got to Normandy in 1944, these guys had been fighting for 3 years against the Soviets. They knew every trick in the book. They were the best battle-hardened veterans in the world. And how we beat them is really still astonishing.
Though the book is called The Second World Wars, we've walked through air, water, earth, and fire. When we come back for part two next week, we will talk about what did we really win? We're here with Victor Davis Hansen at his farm, classicist historian. We'll catch you next time.
Storm clouds been gathering so long, I don't know.
The darkness around us leaves no easy road.
We started wondering if every road dead ends our dreams. Wind whips the dust up and rain's pouring down.
Good people struggling in every hometown.
We started wondering if we even matter at all. Trial by fire like this.
It's nothing hard work and family can fix.
We've got the power to save it all here in our hands. We'll take that hard road to happier days. Cause we kept our American faith. We the people.
not afraid.
That's why they call her the home of the brave.
With a prayer and a purpose, we're already half the way there. We'll take that hard road to happier days. 'Cause we've kept our American faith.
Paid for by Devin Nunes Campaign Committee.